We in John 9, you can open up there. John 9, if you're using the Bibles under the chairs, you'll find this on page 1070. In the Gospels, not just John, but Matthew, Mark, and Luke as well, what we find is a mix of teaching and actions. There'll be long sections where Jesus instructs, sometimes interacting, sometimes more of like a, we think of like a lecture style. So long sections of teaching, and then sections of actions where he's healing, or there's narrative as people discuss that. In both of those, though, it's designed to teach. Whether it's recording the words of Christ or the actions of Christ, those are there to teach us about him, teach us who he is. And so in John 8, Jesus taught. He identified himself, if you recall there, as the, light of the world, as the great I am, the God of the Old Testament, the one who could set people free from sin. And so if you were to look at chapter 8, you would see, if you have a red letter Bible, you would see lots of red as he's teaching. In chapter 9, Jesus acts. He heals a blind man. And that action, though, is connected to the teaching of chapter 8. In chapter 8, he says, I'm the light of the world. And then in chapter 9, he heals a blind man to show that he is the light. He's the one who gives light, who opens eyes. What we learn in chapter 9 is that there are two kinds of blindness. There's a physical blindness, this man who was blind from birth who could not see, and Jesus heals that. But we learn that there is a spiritual blindness as well. And Jesus heals the first to expose the second. He heals this physically blind man to expose how some, even in the face of great miracles, just refused to see. And they were blind spiritually. This helps us in a few ways. It helps us understand God himself, always, as we go through this. It helps us understand people, in particularly, why will some people, even when exposed to the same evidence that was persuasive to you, maybe when you came to Christ, they don't see it. They seem hard to it. They don't respond. This passage is helping to expose some of why that happens. Let's go ahead and read this now. I'll tell you, it is a little bit longer. We'll take the whole chapter, though, in one go, because it is all one big unit, and it's mostly narrative, not like detailed teaching. But it'll take a little while to read through it. So chapter 9, I'll read verses 1 to 41. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he would be born blind? Jesus answered, it was neither that this man sinned, nor his parents, but it was so that the work of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me as long as it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world. When he said this, he spat on the ground, made clay of the spittle, and applied the clay to his eyes, and said to him, go, wash in the pool of Siloam, which is translated sent. So he went away and washed and came back seeing. Therefore, the neighbors and those who previously saw him as a beggar were saying, isn't this not the one who used to sit and beg? Others were saying, this is he. Still others were saying, no, but he is like him. He kept saying, I'm the one. So they were saying to him, how then were your eyes opened? He answered, the one who was called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, go to Siloam and wash. So I went away and washed, and I received sight. They said to him, where is he? He said, I do not know. They brought to the Pharisees the man who was formerly blind. Now it was the Sabbath, on the day when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. Then the Pharisees also were asking him again how he received his sight. And he said to them, he applied clay to my eyes, and I washed, and I see. Therefore, some of the Pharisees were saying, this man is not from God, because he does not keep the Sabbath. But others were saying, how can a man who is a sinner perform such signs? There was a division among them. So they said to the blind man again, what do you say about him since he opened your eyes? And he said, he is a prophet. The Jews then did not believe it of him, that he had been blind and had received sight, until they called the parents of the very one who had received his sight. and questioned them, saying, "Is this your son, who you say was born blind? Then how does he now see?" His parents answered them and said, "We know this is our son and that he was born blind, but how he now sees, we do not know, or who opened his eyes, we do not know. Ask him, he is of age, he will speak for himself." His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that if anyone confessed him to be Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. For this reason, his parents said, "He is of age, ask him." So a second time they called a man who had been born blind and said to him, "Give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner." He then answered, "Whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see." So they said to him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered them, "I told you already, and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? You do not want to become his disciples too, do you?" They reviled him and said, "You are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he is from." The man answered and said to him, "Well, here is an amazing thing that you do not know where he is from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is God-fearing and does his will, he hears him. Since the beginning of time, it has never been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a person born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." They answered him, "You were born entirely in sins. Are you teaching us?" So they put him out. Jesus heard that they had put him out, and finding him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He answered, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" Jesus said to him, "You have both seen him, and he is the one who is talking with you." And he said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, so that those who do not see may see, those who see may become blind." Those of the Pharisees who were with him heard these things and said to him, "We are not blind too, are we?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But since you say, 'We see,' your sin remains." It's a great story. I love this narrative. We're just going to look at it in three parts. This physical blindness that Jesus heals, the spiritual blindness on display, and then spiritual sight. As we look at the spiritual blindness, we'll see three kind of demonstrations of spiritual blindness that we might still see today. But let's start with this physical blindness and the miracle that healed it. The disciples asked a question of Jesus based on a wrong assumption. There was a popular Jewish doctrine at the time that all physical suffering is the direct result of personal sin. So they saw this man blind, and they said, "Well, there's two options. Either he sinned or his parents sinned. Which is it, Jesus?" It's the same mindset, really, that Job's friends had in the book of Job, where they saw him suffering, and they assumed, you must be a sinner if this is happening. We might scoff at this and think, how could they think that way? Yeah, I think we sometimes betray the same mindset when something bad happens to us, or we maybe, we hear somebody else, saying something like this. Something bad happens, an unexpected sickness, a hardship, and either what is expressed, what they actually say, or what goes on in the heart is, "Oh, Lord, why is this happening to me? What did I do to deserve this?" And there's either a sense of it's unfair. They're looking at their life and saying, "What have I done to deserve it?" Or there's a sense of despair and grief. They're saying, "I must have done something, some sin to bring this on." And they're racked with guilt trying to figure out what it is. That betrays really the same mindset, that if there's suffering, it must have an immediate cause in sin. And this passage, as well as countless others in scriptures, would say, no. Sometimes God does bring hardship as a form of discipline to get our attention. We need to be mindful of that. But it's also just part of living in a broken world affected by sin. And there's ways in which God can even use suffering for his glory, as he does in this case. So they look back. The disciples look back and say, what must have happened in the past to cause this? And yet Jesus encourages them to look forward. How could God use this for his glory? And that is God's intent. His life would have been very difficult up to this point. I want you to keep in mind what life as a blind man in the first century would have been like. When we encounter blind people in the Gospels, what are they almost always doing? Perhaps always. They're at the side of the road begging. That was their way to take care of themselves. They depended upon the generosity of others. There was no Americans with Disabilities Act. There was no concern to make sure that they could navigate life as an unseeing person in a seeing world. There's nothing like that. And add to that this mindset that is betrayed by the disciples, that most people would assume they're in that condition because of their own sin and that they brought it upon themselves. You can imagine how that would affect the lack of compassion that they would feel. So Jesus says, no, it's that the works of God might be displayed in him. Verse 4, he must work the works of him who sent me as long as it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. And I think what he's talking about there is his own upcoming death and his being taken away, death and resurrection and ascension. But he says, while I'm in the world, I'm the light of the world. Which, remember, that's what he explains in chapter 8, verse 12, with this great candelabra in the background at the Feast of Tabernacles. And he says, I'm the light of the world. And we walked through what that meant. And now he brings it up again as he's just about to open this guy's eyes physically. He says, I'm the light of the world. And then he does something in verse 6 that if you're like a germaphobe, you probably don't like it very much, right? He spits in the ground and he makes clay and puts on the guy's eyes. Why on earth would he do it this way? We know throughout the Gospels he can heal from a city away. We saw that in, I think it was in John 4. He didn't even go to where the sick person was. He healed him. We see that he can heal without touching somebody. We can see that some blind people, he touches them and heals them. And then we see here, he makes clay and puts it on the guy's eye and uses that to heal him. It's still a divine healing. It's not like a medicinal thing. And yet, why? The text doesn't directly say why he chose this method, but I think we can imply it from what goes on, because the controversy is over the Sabbath. It's on the Sabbath. And so I think what he's doing is deliberately pushing the buttons of the Pharisees, who would object to his, what in their mind was a violation of the Sabbath. I don't actually think it was. It was such a small thing. And human need supersedes the Sabbath, Jesus would teach in other places. But I think that's why he chooses this method, is because of the Sabbath discussion that comes up and what they conclude about him. But Jesus heals the man. And it's described just so briefly. I want us to pause, though, and consider what this would have meant. This man, we're told, was blind from birth. So that would have meant up until this moment, he would have felt the warmth of the sun, but never have seen the sun or seen a shadow. He would have maybe felt a flower if somebody put it in his hands, but he never would have seen one. He never would have seen the colors. He would have heard his mom's voice, but never seen her face. And on and on and on. But it just describes he came back seeing. This physical blindness that is healed, though, only takes up, what, 7 verses. The rest of the chapter is the interaction and the controversy about it. And I think that's designed to display this spiritual blindness. And I draw that conclusion because of how the chapter ends up. So let's turn to that, this spiritual blindness that's on display. There's a series of interactions. And I could even hear some chuckling in the crowd as we read through it, because you pick up on some of the humor that I think is intended in here, that I think John is putting on display in this. So we see these series of interactions. This first one in verses 8 to 12 is with this man's neighbors, where they're debating. They're saying, is this the guy that was blind birth? And they're just like, no, he just must look like him. And the guys are like, no, it's me. I'm the one that's been blind since birth. But they don't quite know what to do with this. And so they bring him to the Pharisees, the Jewish religious leaders. And we see this kind of ominous note in verse 14 that it was the Sabbath day when Jesus made the clay. That's what's tipping us off, that's what they're going to be upset about. And so the Pharisees, they ask him, what happened? And now for the second time, he recounts the same thing. We saw in verse 11, him just kind of This guy called Jesus, put clay in my eyes. I went, I washed, and now I see. And they ask him again, what happened? He applied clay to my eyes, I washed, I see. They're just kind of asking him to keep repeating this story. So they ask him, they're interviewing him, and the Pharisees, even themselves, are divided. Some accused him of being a sinner because he violated the Sabbath. They say, this cannot be because this man broke the Sabbath. So he can't be anything but a sinner. Again, speaking of the blind man, not the blind man, but of Jesus. But others were saying, no, he performed this miracle. How could that be if he is such a sinner? And so verse 16 says there was division, even among the Pharisees. And they asked the blind man, what do you say about him? And he says, he's a prophet, which, as we've seen throughout John at different times, is accurate but insufficient. And as the narrative goes on, one of the interesting things to see is how that changes, even for this man. But here he gives an accurate but insufficient answer. He's the prophet. He's a prophet. But we'll see him land at even a deeper truth at the end. So now they pivot to somebody else. So we go from the neighbors to the Pharisees interviewing this man, and now they go to interview his parents in verses 18 to 22. And the parents are, understandably, from what we're told here, kind of cagey in their answers, kind of nervous. They say, yeah, this is our son. He was born blind. Now he sees. We don't know how that happened. And it tells us because they were worried. They were afraid because they knew that Jews, as the Jewish leaders, had already said if anybody confessed Jesus to be the Christ, they were to be put out of the synagogue. Here's what that meant. According to the writings at the time, there was really like three levels of excommunication to be put out of the synagogue. One would have been fairly temporary for 7 days. One would have been a little bit higher than that. Person would have been publicly reprimanded 3 times in the synagogue and then put out for some period of time. But the third was the most serious. They were excluded for an indefinite amount of time, and no one was permitted to teach, to work for, or benefit the offender in any way. So consider what that would have been meant to be put out. It wasn't just that, well, they couldn't go to the synagogue one day a week. No, it would be to be excluded from Jewish society, religious as well as civil, in the sense that their whole community would have been involved in this and would not have been able to work for them or benefit them in any way. And so they were afraid of that. Unlike their son, who we'll see holds firm, in fear they didn't want to plant a flag and say that it was this Jesus who healed him. So they say, go ask him. Go ask him. What we see is the Pharisees continuing to ask for evidence, but then rejecting it, any evidence they find based on false preconceptions. So in verse 16 and leading up to that, as they interact with the neighbors, as they then interact with this man, the preconception is he broke the Sabbath by making, I mean, think about it, like how much clay could you make by spitting in the ground? I mean, practice it today, right? I don't know. If you have a brother, put it on the brother's eyes. No, I'm just kidding. But like how much work could you do? Because that's what they're saying, basically. He worked. He made, a tablespoon of clay. And so their preconception is, that's work, which I think would go beyond what the Old Testament Sabbath laws required. And it pushes against what Jesus says throughout the Gospels when he's confronted for doing good on the Sabbath, that human need supersedes this. It's good to heal even on the Sabbath. But their preconceived idea is like, no, he broke this rule, and therefore it can't be real. It can't be true. He can't be the Messiah. He can't be from God. And so they have preconceptions, and it just leads to this spiritual blindness. I think we can see modern examples where somebody, maybe they have a preconception of the material world explains everything. Everything can be explained through scientific observation in the material world. And so if any explanation for, let's say, the origin of the universe, having a divine origin from God, or an explanation of the human soul or things, if it doesn't fit within a materialistic mindset that they have and enter into it, it's just rejected out of hand. That would be a preconceived idea that then just rejects any evidence. We see another aspect of spiritual blindness as more evidence is given. It asks for more evidence, but then rejects it when it is supplied. So they're asking the neighbors, they're asking the man, they ask his parents, and yet none of it is enough to convince them. They're asking for evidence, but not really, because they're not engaging with the evidence. Think of an example of that several years ago when I was serving in the college pastor role, where Kyler's serving in that now. And remember, we did an event on campus. Ended up meeting a student who would describe himself as an atheist, but wanted to interact. And so we exchanged some emails after that. And he'd bring up a question, and I would answer it in a way that I thought was sufficient and was specific, and it would get at what he was saying. And then he would write back, but rather than interacting with my answer, he would raise like 8 more questions. And then I'd try to answer that, and it would be other questions. And it's possible that my answers weren't like, you know, the best or something like that. And yet what it was displaying was he wasn't interacting with that. He wasn't interacting with the evidence I brought up. He just went on to something else and something else and something else. I think it's a pattern we can see today at different times where people, they say they want evidence, but really they don't interact with the evidence. And it's revealing a spiritual blindness. Or maybe there's evidence given for, say, the detailed prophetic fulfillments in Scripture. And you can look at specifics fulfilled in the birth and life and death of Jesus that were predicted hundreds of years beforehand, many, many hundreds of years, some 700 to 1,000 years beforehand, and fulfilled with great precision. Or rulers in the Old Testament who were identified by name 150 years before they were even born, and changes in kingdoms and nationalities centuries before it would happen. And yet rather than dealing with that evidence, it's discounted and moved on to something else. That can be a form of spiritual blindness. So these Pharisees are demonstrating that, even as they're going through the motions of interviewing and asking questions. And so they talk to the neighbors, they talk to the man, they talk to his parents, and now they go back to the man for round 2 in verses 23 to 34. And you see there they appeal to him, give glory to God, meaning tell the truth. That's a way of saying, kind of like at a courtroom, somebody says, put your hand on the Bible and swear. Now they're saying, give glory to God. Tell the truth here. Tell the truth. We know this man is a sinner. Basically, we know this. We just need you to confirm it. But we already know this. And they're rejecting any evidence to the contrary. And although the man would have not been as powerful or as well-trained as the Pharisees, he just sticks to his story. And he says, whether he's a sinner, I don't know. I just know that I was blind. Now I see. He said, he opened my eyes. He opened my eyes. And then when they poke at him, say, what did he do? How did he open his eyes? I love his answer in verse 27. I told you already and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? You know, basically, do you want to become his disciples? Yeah, as we're reading through it, I mean, he's repeated it a couple times, and it's not a complicated story, right? I was blind, put the clay on my eyes, I washed, I see. You know, he repeats that several times, like, do you want me to say it again? But no, they reject that. They start to revile him, verse 28, meaning they attack verbally. They compare him to Moses, Jesus to Moses. And they say, we don't even know where he's from, which has been an attack actually several times throughout John. They're saying they don't know his origin, don't know where he's from. And again, we see the man's almost humorous response. You know, it's an amazing thing. You don't know where he's from, and yet he opened my eyes. And then he actually uses pretty tight logic here. If you were to write it as like a syllogism, a 3-part syllogism, it's pretty good. Basically, he says, only God can heal. Jesus healed me. Therefore, Jesus is from God. That's essentially what he says. Only God can heal. Jesus healed me. Therefore, Jesus is from God. Pretty tight logic. But they would use what's, we'd call a logical fallacy. What do they say back? Do they deal with the principles of that syllogism? No, they say, you were born entirely in sins, verse 34. And are you teaching us? That would be called an ad hominem, right? They attack his character rather than his argument. If you want to see evidence of this today, just open what's called the internet and see the way that people often interact there. Rather than dealing with maybe an argument or points that people are making, there's an attack on the individual. And so that's what they do. They attack him, and then they put him out. And so if we were to make an observation, and again, these are just observations from a narrative, but I think it's worth pointing out. It appears to be an observation like this, that spiritual blindness, one thing that it can do sometimes is attack character to reject truth. Maybe you're trying to interact on evidences for the faith or a biblical worldview, and you, rather than interacting with the arguments you're making, somebody mocks or they call you ignorant or naive, but they don't evaluate the weight of the argument or the evidence. It can be a display in a similar way, I think, of spiritual blindness. So we go physical blindness, spiritual blindness on display, and then spiritual sight in this last section. Verse 34 ends with them putting him out. And remember what that means. To put out means they excommunicated him, they put him out of the synagogue, and if it's that most serious form, which it likely is, that means for an indefinite period of time until it's reversed, he is excluded from the civil and religious society, that nobody is to teach him, nobody is to work for him, to benefit him in any way. He is to be excluded. So they put him out. And so, verse 35, when Jesus heard that they had put him out, and finding him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? But notice that. Jesus hasn't interacted with him since he healed him. All this has been going on. But now that the man's been put out, it doesn't just say Jesus ran into him. It says he found him. He went for him to have this conversation. He found him. The man was probably just severed from his friends, the religious community. Depending on what his parents do, if they still live in fear of this, perhaps severed even from his parents themselves. And it's as if Jesus is to say, they might not want you, but I want you. I will take you. And so he finds him. And the man, you can tell, has been prepared in his heart to receive this. Jesus asked, do you believe in the Son of Man? And he answered, who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him? Basically, whoever he is, because you've done this, and I see, I will believe in him. And look at verse 37. Isn't it just beautiful? Jesus could have said, he could have answered his question, it's me. And yet what does he say? You have both seen him, and he is the one who is talking to you. Well, why can he see him? Because he can see. Because Jesus opened his eyes. And so he says, you've seen him. And it's the one who's talking to you. He says, it's me. And he says, Lord, I believe. And he worshiped him. So this man goes from this by saying he's a prophet to even interacting with the Pharisees. Like, I don't know if he's a sinner or not, but he opened my eyes and I see. To now, Lord, I believe. And it's a belief that leads to worship. And for an observant Jew to worship, what does that conclude? That worship was for God alone. It would have been drilled into him since he was young, and yet he worships Christ. He sees. He believes. Remember, the purpose of the miracles in the Gospel of John, we're told at the end of the book in John chapter 20, verse 31, these things have been written so that you may believe that he is the Christ, the Son of God, and believing you may have life in his name. He believes that he may have life. From there, though, there's another conversation. And it could be the Pharisees were kind of standing on the outskirts and seeing this, and now he interacts with them. It could be that it's a separate conversation, but related, and so it's included here. So verse 38, the man says, Lord, I believe, and he worshiped him. Verse 39, Jesus says, "For judgment I came into this world, so those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind." Just pausing right there. If you've been with us through John, that might kind of raise a question for you. We saw in John chapter 3, Jesus said, "For God did not send the Son into the world to judge the world, but that the world might be saved through him." And yet he says here, "For judgment I came into the world." Why does he say here, "For God did not send the Son into the world to judge the world, but the world might be saved"? But then in this chapter he says, "No, for judgment I came into the world." We talked about it a little bit in chapter 3. The idea there is that the purpose of Christ's coming was to save. It was to save. But judgment comes when salvation is rejected. It's the inevitable result. Just like you might think of the purpose of the sun is to give light, but when the sun is blocked, it creates a shadow. The purpose is not to cause shadows, but it is the inevitable result. So in the same way, he came to save. He just came to save us from our problem, our biggest problem, our sin against a holy God, our rebellion against him that's in the heart and in our actions. And he came to live and to die ultimately for us so that we who turn and believe, we turn from sin and trust in him, we believe we're saved. But for those who reject, the only other option is judgment. There's no kind of middle ground. It's judgment. And so he would say, "For judgment I came into this world." For those who reject, that is what they experience. So the Pharisees who were with him heard these things. So at least verse 39 and perhaps the whole interaction with this young man, they say, "We are not blind too, are we?" They said, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But since you say we see, your sin remains." In other words, you're claiming to have sight, but you're demonstrating blindness, and yes, this judgment will fall on you if you do not believe. I was talking with Lori here, who does our sign language interpretation before the service, and she was asking about this terminology for spiritual sight, spiritual blindness, because she said there's two different signs she can do, and she wanted to know which one to do. Probably not going to get the signs just right, so you can look at her to see how to do it correctly. We'll put Lori on display here. For the spiritual blindness, one is like a blindness where you just don't see. You just, you know, something's right in front of you, you just don't see it. And the other is like a hard-hearted turning away, not seeing. And she's asking, which is it? Which sign should she do? After going through this passage, what would you guys say? Which sign is it? Seems like it's this. The evidence is there. This miracle. They talk to the parents, they talk to the young man a couple times. They can't get away from that, and yet they're in hardness of heart, not seeing. And it illustrates this principle that Jesus must open our eyes. And isn't that often what we pray for somebody who doesn't know Christ? We say, "God, open their eyes. Oh, open their eyes." That's what we're praying for. God, let them see this evidence. Do a work that only you can. So the evidence that's there, they see. And they believe. And yet for these Pharisees, they're not seeing. And so often, likewise today, people don't see. And maybe that's you. And if that's the case, I just encourage you, one, to look honestly at it. Are you operating off of preconceptions or looking at the evidence? But also just pray honestly. God, open my eyes. If I'm blind to this, open my eyes.